Greetings, and it's nice to be sharing the program with you again. We're going through the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by the Tibetan Buddhist master Namgyal Pal, a text that mainly deals with developing bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment for the temporary and ultimate benefit of all living beings. This, in Mahayana Buddhism, is regarded as the greatest and best intention, because it seeks the benefit of countless beings, in fact so many that not even the least is left out. Now, we've used this motivation for all our programs so far, so now, before we go on, let's take a moment to reflect on it and to make it the motivation for this program as well. If you really cannot, though, at least think that the program will be the cause for your own liberation. Thank you. Continuing our discussion of bodhicitta, normally, of course, we only look for the benefit of ourselves first, and then those close to us. The further we regard others from us, the less concern we have for them. But this attitude, says the Buddha's teachings, has been our downfall in countless situations up to now, and has never brought us even the vestige of lasting happiness. Only when we have the same loving and compassionate attitude to each and every being can we be said to approach real happiness, which tells us basically that we have to change our minds. For where else do the selective habits lie if not in our minds? For countless lifetimes, we've been taught in various ways, some conscious and some not so much, to put ourselves first. We think that our happiness is the most worthwhile there is, and we have sought to fulfill only our own aims, even when they conflicted with the aims of others. But where has all that led us? If we look at our current situation, most of us will find at least some dissatisfaction, although many, including the most wealthy, will find a lot to complain about. Even those of us in the best situations have our gripes and moans. The Buddha, who was an expert at suffering and how it comes about, said that, not to speak about the enormous sufferings we might go through in the hellish situations, even our smallest grizzle has its origin in this attitude of putting oneself first and disregarding the well-being of others. So this self-serving attitude has not helped to alleviate our pain. Rather, it has ensured that we suffer more and more. From the Buddha's point of view, it is actually the opposite, somewhat counterintuitive attitude that is our happiness generator. The more we can cherish and concern ourselves with others, the happier we become and the less we suffer. And following that logic to its end means that if we can free ourselves from all self-concern and live only to benefit others, we will attain the greatest happiness. Now, of course, this would be a very different kettle of fish if there were a real and independent self. Then not cherishing self could lead to some serious difficulties. But part of the reason the Buddha could teach this rather radical about-face from our usual attitude was that such an independent self cannot be found out, no matter how profoundly and diligently we look. It is just a mental fabrication and has no reality as anything other than a mental fabrication whatsoever. Now, this is true. It is totally valid, then, to train the mind in letting go of self-grasping and self-cherishing, for then we're making ourselves more and more familiar with what actually is, instead of conjuring for ourselves a world in which to live, which is what we are doing all the time, based on our self-appreciation. Ultimately, we have to realize no independent self exists anywhere, not in me, not in you, and not in anything that we see, hear, taste, touch, or smell. And to do that, we have to change our whole internal premise and landscape. That is where mind training comes in, based on bodhicitta, even if it's just aspiring bodhicitta. But the vast majority of us can't go from "I am the center of the universe and the most important thing there is" to "May I take on all others' suffering and may they have all my happiness," all in a moment. That would be asking a bit much. So we have to start where we are and slowly, slowly work our way onwards. As I've told you before, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that if there was a magic pill that could take us to Nirvana in an instant, he would be the one standing on the street corner doling it out for free. But no such thing exists, and all we have is deluded mind to work with. We train it as much as we can to adopt the positive and avoid the negative. All Buddhist practice is based on a vastly positive mind, so creating this becomes imperative for us, and hence the mind training teachings. The great Indian master Atisha showed us one way of training the mind, and that is by formulating, learning, and adopting slogans that could pop into one's appropriate times to guide one's attitude and behavior. These slogans or maxims appear in mind training like the rays of the sun, and we've gone through some of them, such as don't maintain inverted loyalty, don't make malicious banter, don't turn gods into demons, and lately, there are two activities at the beginning and the end, and train first and the easiest practices. Oh, we touched on train first and the easiest practices last time, and if you were with us, you may remember that Namkar Pel commented, if you feel that it is difficult to take on the miseries of others and to give up your own happiness and merits, recall that at the present you are training in these practices only on a mental level. When, due to acquaintance, you have great gained prowess, actually engaging in giving and taking will not be difficult. And to show why, on a purely physical level, we have to go slowly in changing our attitude, we then called on Walter Chen on blog.bufferapp.com to explain how the brain can be rewired to forsake its negative default mode and adopt positive thinking. He pointed out that even though our survival instinct has programmed us to look at things negatively, we are not therefore damned forever. He says, fortunately, we aren't doomed by our natural disposition towards negativity. What's amazing is that we have the ability to break out of that negative feedback loop, and we can actually rewire our brains to think positively. Understanding how the brain can refashion its own connections is the key to unlocking the durable power of positive thinking. And he went on to explain how this happens using the Tetris effect, and ended his article with some steps we can take to start on the path to positive thinking. First, he says, at the end of each day, we can make a list of three specific good things that happened that day and reflect on what caused them to happen. We can also celebrate whatever success we've achieved during the day. Not only will that bring a lot of joy, but it will also give a boost to our motivation. He recommends taking time to thank or recognize someone else for their efforts, those close to us as well as anyone else we come across. And agreeing with the Buddha's teachings, he says we should always act with kindness whenever we can. Finally, he recommends we stay mindful as much as possible, that is, paying attention to the present moment without judgment. And he says the regular practice of mindfulness meditation has also been shown to affect the brain's plasticity, increasing gray matter in the hippocampus, an area of the brain important for learning, memory, and emotion, and reducing gray matter in the amygdala, an area of the brain associated with stress and anxiety. So that is what we ended with last time, and now let's look at another article that bears out what Walter Chen says and takes it a bit further. It's on the website www.lifehacker.com.au, and it's by Thorin Klosowski. It's entitled The Science Behind How We Learn New Skills. It goes like this. Learning new skills is one of the best ways to make yourself both marketable and happy, but actually doing so isn't as easy as it sounds. The science behind how we learn is the foundation for teaching yourself new skills. Here's what we know about learning a new skill. Our brains are still a bit of a mystery. We'll likely be learning about how our brain works for years to come, but we are starting to get a better idea of how we learn new things. To that end, let's start talking about what happens in your brain as you take on a new skill set before moving on to some of the scientific ways to learn. And here, Klosowski more or less goes over what Walter Chen said last time, but let's go with him, even just to review what we've discovered. He says, every time you learn something new, your brain changes in a pretty substantial way. In turn, this makes other parts of your life easier, because the benefits of learning stretch further than just being good at something. He then quotes an article in the New Yorker about older people overcoming the commonly accepted dictum that you have to learn skills when you're young because you can't when you're old. After saying that old people just have to take on such learning in a different way, Plasasi points out that the article finds learning a new skill among old or young has all kinds of unexpected benefits, such as improving working memory, better verbal intelligence, and increased language skills. He continues, likewise, as you learn a new skill, the skill actually gets easier to do. And he quotes from a study conducted at Cornell University, which states, specifically, training resulted in decreased activity in brain regions involved in effortful control and attention that closely overlap with the frontoparietal control and dorsal attentional networks. Increased activity was found after training, however, in the default network that is involved in self-reflective activities, including future planning or even daydreaming. Thus, skill mastery is associated with increased activity in areas not engaged in skill performance, and this shift can be detected in the large-scale networks of the brain. Essentially, Klasowski says, the more adept you become at a skill, the less work your brain has to do. Over time, a skill becomes automatic and you don't need to think about what you're doing. This is because your brain is actually strengthening itself over time as you learn that skill. And then he takes a quote from an article in Scientific American, which goes, many different events can increase a synapse's strength when we learn new skills. The process that we understand best is called long-term potentiation, in which repeatedly stimulating two neurons at the same time fortifies the link between them. After a strong connection is established between these neurons, stimulating the first neuron will more likely excite the second. In addition to making existing synapses more robust, learning causes the brain to grow larger. Optical imaging allows researchers to visualize this growth in animals. For instance, when a rat learns a difficult skill, such as reaching through a hole for a pellet of food, within minutes, new protrusions called dendritic spines grow on the synapses in its motor cortex, the region that allows animals to plan and execute movements. That's Scientific American. Continues Klosowski, the more connections between neurons are formed, the more we learn, and the more information we retain. And as those connections get stronger, the less we have to think about what we're doing, which means we can get better at other facets of a set of skills. We're still learning about learning, so while we can see how learning skills affects the brain, we're still digging into exactly why it happens and all the benefits of doing so. As the old saying goes, practice makes perfect, but how we practice is just as important as if we're practicing. He then shows us how we can use the science to learn faster. He says, knowing how your brain adapts to new skills is just part of the process. That knowledge is worthless if you don't know how to apply it. With that in mind, let's dig into some of the tried and true methods of learning new skills as quickly as possible. It's all about boosting your brain power in one way or another. Thankfully, it's surprisingly easy. An initial step is to try learning without guides or help. As he says, when we are learning a new skill, it's easy to rely on YouTube, tutorials, walkthroughs, and guides to help get the process started. And that's great for those beginning days. But if we keep doing that, we won't ever actually learn because we're not solving problems on our own. In order to learn, we need to fail. And he quotes science writer Annie Murphy-Paul, who calls this type of failure productive failure. She says, we've heard a lot lately about the benefits of experiencing and overcoming failure. One way to get these benefits is to set things up so that you're sure to fail by tackling a difficult problem without any instruction or assistance. Manu Kapoor, a researcher at the Learning Sciences Lab at the National Institute of Education of Singapore, has reported in the Journal of the Learning Sciences that people who try solving math problems in this way don't come up with the right answer, but they do generate a lot of ideas about the nature of the problems and about what potential solutions would look like, leading them to perform better on such problems in the future. Kapoor calls this productive failure, and you can implement it in your own by allowing yourself to struggle with a problem for a while before seeking help or information. Klosowski uses the example of learning guitar. He says, you can easily hunt down the tablature for painted black online, but that's not going to help you learn the actual sound of each chord you're playing. Instead, try to figure out on your own instead of seeking out the answer. This is essentially learning by trial and error, which is frustrating, but works really well. The same goes for any number of other skills. Sure, sometimes you need to break down and search for a solution, but you're going to be better off if you don't. So how does this translate to our practice? Well, certainly in meditation practice, it's good to approach the mind and everything that goes on in it with curiosity, even in the initial stages. In the spirit of experimentation, try different methods, always keeping the attention alert and sharp so that any revelations and insights can be realized. Of course, we may make mistakes and we'll need to get guidance on the practice and be aware of pitfalls and so on. But that doesn't mean we also need to become rigid. In my understanding, in the Zen practice, very little guidance is given and meditators have to do very much work on their own way. It's not quite like that in the Tibetan system with its emphasis on advice from the guru. But I think even a good Tibetan teacher will also let students sometimes fall into difficult situations and leave them to work out their own solutions. In any case, unless the guru is clairvoyant, the student is the only one knowing how their own mind works, and so will have to be ready for some productive failure. Klosowski's next instruction is to spread the learning out over time. He says, when we're picking up a new skill or learning something entirely new, it's easy to binge learn and obsessively work on it over time. However, that's not always the best idea. In fact, spreading out learning, also known as distributive practice, is thought to be a better way to learn. A review of studies in psychological science in the public interest found that spreading out learning is far more effective than cramming. He quotes, Donlosky and colleagues report that spreading out your studying over time and quizzing yourself on material before the big test are highly effective learning strategies. Both techniques have been shown to boost students' performance across many different kinds of tests, and their effectiveness has been repeatedly demonstrated for students of all ages. And he quotes Donlosky with this, I was shocked that some strategies that students use a lot, such as rereading and highlighting, seem to provide minimal benefits to their learning and performance. By just replacing rereading with delayed retrieval practice, students would benefit. Kloskowski says that distributed practice is an old technique, but actually works well for busy lives. He says, instead of sitting down for hours on end to learn a skill, distributed practice is all about shorter, smaller sessions where you're stimulating the link between the neurons more often throughout time. So instead of trying to learn a skill by taking an hour-long class every night, give yourself a lot of time overall and small chunks throughout the day. Heck, even 15 minutes a day to spend on projects is enough for many of us. This is very much in line with Tibetan teachers' advice for meditation practice. They say we should preferably do several short sessions rather than a few long sessions, and definitely not push or binge practice, following Klosowski's description. I know that other traditions introduce students into long, intense sessions, but the Tibetans warn that this can lead to psychic difficulties, like the disturbance called lung, which leads to an inability to meditate. I have met people who have developed this tightness of mind, and it makes life difficult. Klosowski then advises us to choose our practice time wisely. You wouldn't think it, he says, but when you study or practice, it's just as important as how. The body's internal clock is tuned to work better during certain points in the day, and that goes for learning as well. According to one study published in the journal PLOS-1, we learn best when we do so before sleep. The study found that subjects who went to sleep right after learning something did significantly better in a series of memory tests. We've seen this before with naps, and know that sleep has a big impact on memory retention in general. Basically, when you learn a new skill before bed, you're helping fortify the link between the neurons in your brain. This means you retain information better. Well, that might be so with study, but often meditation practice is better done when the mind is fresh and not gearing up for sleep. We would agree that it depends on your mind. Some people are morning creatures and others work better at night. So we would do well again to experiment and find the time of day that best suits our practice. But I would not think it good to study or meditate if the mind is sleepy or dulling out. Next, Klosowski brings up an important point in saying that it's important to apply our skills every day. We're big proponents of experiential learning here at Lifehacker, he says, and that's because it's often the best way to learn the types of skills we talk about here. The more you can apply what you're learning to your everyday, the more it'll stick in your head. The reason is simple. When you're learning by doing, you're implementing everything that makes our memory work. When you're able to connect what you're learning with a real-world task, that forms the bonds in your brain, and subsequently, the skills you're learning will stick around. This is especially true with learning a foreign language, where application is the key to learning quickly. You can do this in a number of ways. For some skills, like music, deliberate practice is a way to be more mindful of what you're doing so you can actually improve. Deliberate practice is all about tracking what you're learning, focusing on short learning sessions, and practicing as smart, not hard. Just like memory, we learn best when we have context, and that applies to new skills as much as it does to random facts in school. That's why something like the transfer of learning is helpful when you're learning a new skill. This means you're applying your new skills in your day-to-day life in a context that matters. For example, if you're learning about mathematics, make sure you find a way to work that into your daily life, even if it's as simple as figuring out your gas mileage every day. It's simple, but it's about forming connections in your brain that actually matter to you. And that is very much in line with the instructions about taking your meditation and other practices into your everyday experiences. All the teachings say that when we get up from the cushion, we need to keep our meditative mind into our continuing activities so that eventually it all becomes one seamless whole. Perhaps some real experiences in a story from the website www.pbs.org will illustrate. It's titled Falling Off a Horse with Mindfulness, and it's by Deborah Scherbelin. She writes, "A few weeks ago, I fell off a horse named Sadie. And okay, what happened was more like flying off than falling until I hit the dirt. That was more like crashing. My body hurt. Sadie was upset. My companions were concerned. But my mind was calm and focused throughout the event, and I truly believe that practicing mindfulness broke my fall. Here's what happened. As horses sometimes do, Sadie spooked and I had no idea why. There wasn't time to wonder because in the next instant, all I noticed was that I was moving rapidly towards the horse's neck. I saw her eyes roll and felt her fear pass through my body like an energy wave. Next, I rocked backwards, but was still aware of staying in the saddle. And then I wasn't in the saddle anymore and witnessed my body popping off airborne over the mare's left shoulder. There wasn't any fear then and there, just that sensation of moving through space. Then I thought, falling through the air is pretty comfortable. Hitting the ground wasn't, but even as I landed, I noticed the sensation of impact. And then I lay there, aware of the dirt in my ears and nose, and focused on locating my body parts one by one. Sadie approached and gently nuzzled my arm. Practicing mindfulness, paying attention to what's happening while it's happening, equipped me to remain present through the entire experience. My mindfulness was as much of a surprise as Sadie's bucking. I couldn't consciously plan on maintaining mindfulness when she spooked, just as I couldn't predict her outburst. But perhaps all those years of training in the safety of my home, sitting solidly on a cushion, eased my mental shift into witnessing and experiencing simultaneously. So that's how I fell off Sadie the first time. A few days later, she spooked again, and I fell off for a second time. Again, I watched as I fell, noticed as I crashed, and even maintained awareness as I felt my helmet break on impact. Since then, Sadie's been resting. My bruises are mostly healed, and I've been musing over what I learnt and what I like to share. Falling off Sadie helped me gain a little confidence that my mind could stay present and calm, even while my body was launching through the air and hitting the ground. See how maintaining mindfulness kept me in the actual experience, without awareness of past or future, consequently without fear of injury or anger towards Sadie. Feel how the clear focus of attention to being in my body parlayed into a kind of physical softness that cushioned the fall, protecting me from the worst injury. Sense Sadie's terror as she spooked, and her concern when she examined me, flat on my back in the dirt. We were in these experiences together, Sadie and I. We weren't alone. And yet, in those instances and within my consciousness, there really wasn't a specific horse or rider. There were simply events and sensations, awareness and attention, mindfulness. Let's finish off today's program with comments from Joseph Goldstein, the great meditator and author of many books, like The Heart of Peace, from which this extract comes. He said, "We need to create a rhythm in our lives, establishing a balance between times when we are engaged, active, and relating in the world, and times when we turn inward." Pascal, the French philosopher and mathematician, very aptly noted, "Most of the problems in the world would be solved if people spent time sitting quietly in their room." And with that, we may say farewell, for now our time is up. Thanks for joining the program today, and I hope you'll do so again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.